You know, I am all about those little pick-me-ups throughout the day. Whether it's conquering work tasks or doing chores around the house, I need a little treat to reward me. It is a must. And you know what gets me smiling every time? Japanese snacks. Not only are they bursting with flavor, but the cute packaging and quirky vibes add an extra layer of fun. That is why teaming up with Boxu, a Japanese snack subscription box, has been an absolute delight. And these aren't your run-of-the-mill grocery store snacks, okay? Every month, Boxu brings you over 20 unique treats that you can normally find only in Japan. Plus, they throw in a nifty guide packed with info about each snack and Japanese culture. So you get to snack while you learn? Are you kidding? This was literally made for me. Oh, and by the way, each box ships straight from Japan, straight to your door. Okay, so I'm going to try one of the snacks for you. I got my little guide right here. I think this week I'm going to go for the Soka Senbei Uma Zarame. This Senbei rice cracker boasts a uniquely irresistibly tart and sweet flavor combination of ume Japanese plum and zarame, a coarse granulated sugar. Cool. Now, this says it contains wheat and soy, so that's good to know for you gluten folks. There are plenty of gluten-free snacks in here. Here's the cracker. Ooh, this looks so good. Let me give it a try. Oh my God. You hear that crunch? It's like tart. It's a little salty. It's a little sweet. Mmm. This is delicious. Mmm. And I never would have gotten to try this if Boxu hadn't sent it straight to my house. Mm. And you know, my favorite thing about Boxu is that they support small family-run businesses in Japan. Boxu has sourced your treats by working with over 245 small makers in Japan, helping out their businesses and helping to preserve their traditions. So if you love trying new and interesting things, or if you know somebody who does, you have got to try out Boxu and get these snacks shipped straight from Japan to your door. And right now, you can use the code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. That's code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. That's BOKKSU.com.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
I don't know the truth. I don't know the way. I don't know what to think. I don't know what to say. Yeah, but that's all right. Yeah, that's okay. I don't know anything.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Factually. My name's Adam Conover, and welcome to the doldrums of the holiday season. That's right. It's that long stretch between December 25th and January 1st, right? No matter what winter holiday you celebrate, you have celebrated it. You have opened all the presents. You have eaten all the fucking cookies. There is nothing more to say to your family, whether in person or over Zoom. You're on good terms, but you've covered all the bases. You've seen all the holiday movies. So now you're just sitting around in your sweatpants, waiting until you can get drunk on New Year's. You know, this is a time where we're all 13 years old again. We can do whatever we want. And unfortunately, there just isn't even much to do. Hell, you can't even go to the movie theater and see a crappy Tim Allen movie with your family. What the hell are you supposed to do? Well, what better time then to fire up the old gaming console, sink into the couch, and start playing some video games, right? I love video games. I play them all the time, and I've been playing them more than ever this year. You can, in fact, watch me play video games while I talk on my Twitch channel at twitch.tv/AdamConover. Like millions of other people, video games are now an integral part of my life. But one thing we forget about this medium is that video games are a relatively new form of entertainment. They got going in the late 1970s. So depending on when you want to date it, this now dominant cultural form, which makes, you know, billions of dollars every year, the biggest video games make far more money than the biggest movies. This form is just about 40 years old. That means, think about it in film terms, we're around like in the 50s. If you're thinking about film, that's where we are today in 2020 with video games. This means that the people who created the very first video games are still alive. In fact, they're not even that old right now. We can't go talk to the earliest stars of the silent film era, but we can talk to the earliest people who made video games. And the thing is, the world in which those pioneers of video games worked was very different from the massive, professionalized studios we know today. These people were not creative executives. They were often just weirdo computer programmers or hobbyists who would, you know, cobble together a game in their spare time and then put an ad in the back of a magazine and send people floppy disks in the mail. It was a wild era, and the basic principles of video game design were laid down in those early years, and they continue to influence video games and the way we think about the world to this day. There's perhaps no better example of this than the game Civilization. You might have heard of this game. It's a globe-spanning strategy game. You play an individual civilization like England or China and guide it from prehistory into the modern era. Now, this game has an incredibly engaging mix of history, fantasy, strategy, and narrative, and the gameplay is just addictive. It's one of those titles that keeps you up hours later than you were supposed to, just clicking one more turn over and over again. I myself have had to delete this game from my hard drive. You know, I had work to get done that didn't involve building a pleasure palace for Kublai Khan or advancing my Persian phalanx against Carthage. But more importantly, this game is now a lens through which millions of people look at the history of the world. The lessons taught by civilization are lessons that people carry forward in the way that they think about the world around them, the way they think about history, and even the way they think about their own lives. Just like film or novels or any other art form influences our worldviews. So I think it's important to ask, where did this game come from? Who came up with this cultural artifact that has now lasted for decades and influenced so many people? Well, the full title of that game, Civilization, is Sid Meier's Civilization. And today we have on the show, I'm happy to say, legendary game designer Sid Meier himself. That's right. It's all his fault that I blew through that essay deadline in college. So I'm going to be talking to him on this episode. This is going to be a low-key fun episode for what should be a low-key fun time. So you know what? Grab a couple cookies, pour yourself an eggnog or whatever your beverage of choice is, and you know, relax. I know it's been hard to do, but let's relax together with this interview with Sid Meier. Sid, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
So look, video games, computer games are, I believe, the greatest new art form of the century, in my opinion. That's what they've grown to be. Did you know that that is what they were when you got started in the late 80s, early 90s, right? Creating, you know, you created one of the greatest game series ever, Civilization. Did you know when you were taking those first steps that that's what this was?
That actually was a question that came up quite a bit back in the early days. I think since there was so much technology involved, and it was kind of a hackers and geeks kind of thing, there was really a question, is it an art form? Is it just a, kind of a use of technology? And I think as we made games, as we showed what they could do, there was that kind of combination of technology, but also creativity, I think, that is part of any art form. So I think we made the case that it was art, art based on some very cool and emerging technology, but there was a lot of creativity involved. And kind of as we learned more and more what we could do, that creativity became more and more part of what games were about.
Well, tell me a little bit about those earliest years. I mean, you founded MicroProse, correct?
Correct.
And you created these series that we still have today. But what was your first inkling of that games had this potential, right? That what drew you to it? I mean, when you got started, it wasn't a foregone conclusion that people would even use computers for games, right?
Very much so. In fact, we were discouraged from using computers. I studied computers in college. They were, you know, IBM mainframes that lived in an air-conditioned room and you went with your deck to punch cards and made your offering to the computer and you got your printout and hoped that it worked. So definitely gaming was discouraged in those early days. And it wasn't until the personal computer, the Atari, the Apple, the Radio Shack computers came about that there was extra computing time available to play games. But games had always been an interest of mine, even as a kid before there were computers. I loved games. So I can kind of combine two things that I enjoyed. I'd studied computers in college and I loved games. And then the time was right to start making games. And I just did that kind of for my own enjoyment. And this industry gradually started to happen and I jumped on board and declared myself a game designer and the rest is history.
What is the first, I'm really curious because you were around in those very early days, what is the first computer game that you remember encountering in your life? Were there games on those IBM mainframes?
There were not. In fact, I tried to put a tic-tac-toe game on the machine, and I got in trouble for that. My account was canceled, so
really?
I had a 2 or 3 year delay in my career based on that.
Wow!
Tic-tac-toe. Yeah, there were. There's something called Space Wars way back then that mm-hmm. if you had access to a graphics terminal you could play, but we didn't have graphics terminals. So it wasn't until a couple of years after college when Space Invaders came into the arcades, Pac-Man, that was kind of the awakening that, oh, these games are fun, but I don't want to have to keep putting quarters into the machine. I want to do this at home. And that was kind of the impetus to play computer games at home was saving those quarters.
And also personal computers, as you mentioned, like those mainframes that you're talking about, those were owned by, they're massive computers owned by what, companies and universities, and you basically had to beg for time on them. So like, yeah, any sort of frivolous use would be frowned upon. But once you could have a computer in your own home, you could do whatever you wanted with it. So people could, or all they were paying for was the electricity.
Exactly. It was your computer. And immediately games took off. That was the untapped need, desire that home computers filled. You know, you could do spreadsheets and other boring stuff, but people really wanted to play games. And the computers evolved in that direction. The early computers were black and white, but people wanted color to be able to play the games as they saw them in the arcade, for example. They wanted more sound. So home computers evolved really based on the needs of gaming to give you more color, more sound, kind of more graphic speed because people wanted to play the games they saw in the arcade and the computers had to kind of keep up.
I never thought of that. You're right. Like in the 80s and early 90s, like home computers really advertised as like, you can do your taxes on it and like, look at the spreadsheet. And I remember like VisiCalc, or is that what it was called? Being like
exactly.
A very early killer app.
It was a killer app.
Yeah. But like, if you look back at those, what rudimentary business formulas must have you been doing on these? Like, doing a spreadsheet on an Apple IIe, it's not like you were really able to do serious, serious business work on it. And yeah, but the idea that games instead obviously would draw people to it, but the idea that games would drive the innovation of the color and everything else, that's not something I ever considered, but so obvious now that you say it.
Things like VisiCalc were kind of the rationalization for getting a computer, and then you really wanted it for the games, but you had to kind of justify it to, whoever you had to justify it to. So, it'll do, VisiCalc and important stuff like word processing. but I really want to play games.
Yeah, even in those very early years, like even Nintendo flirted with having, it's not just games. It comes with a little robot. It's like educational. Like there was this whole element of a fig leaf that had to be put on the industry.
There was a shame to being a gamer. He was like, you're wasting your time playing games. Don't you have anything better to do?
Some of the first games that you worked on were flight simulators, right? Which had, they also had that veneer of seriousness to them. Like, oh no, you're learning to fly a plane.
That's true. I think we, you know, in the age of Pac-Man and Space Invaders and games like that, we thought there was a market for games that were a little more, had a little more depth to them, kind of, you know, real world games like flight simulators. And, you know, we were expanding the audience, expanding the market because we were, you know, we considered that like the Wild West. It was, mm-hmm. it was the, you know, the early days and we didn't know what we could or could not do. So we might as well try, you know, all sorts of different things, whether it's a flight simulator or pirates or, you know, we ended up with doing Civilization. But so many, you know, varied topics were done, you know, we made games on because we didn't know what was not possible. So we figured we'd give it a try.
Right. I'm always really fascinated by, and this is kind of an aside, but I'm curious if you have thoughts on it, about the Wild West years in any market or any space. You know, like I got my start doing video on the internet before YouTube. Like we were uploading QuickTime videos in like 2005 to our own web servers that people were watching with my college sketch comedy group. And we had massive hits for the time. And it's because there was like no other video content. Our videos exactly. were not very good, frankly, but there was nothing else to watch. And people were like, wow, a funny video on the internet. I didn't know this existed. And then they would send it to each other. And now we never would have been able to survive because online video is so saturated. YouTube is so competitive, but those Wild West years gave us room to experiment and for things to catch on early. And I wonder, having gone through something similar, what that was like for you.
Very much the same. We would be wondering what new game is going to come out this month, you know? today it's like, what 27 games are going to come out today between right. noon and 1 o'clock? So it's very different in that regard. The other difference is we were really discovering the technology as we went. A lot of the games we made in the early days were based on some new capability of the hardware that we discovered. You know, at one point we figured out how to make a smoothly scrolling map that would move around the screen. And, you know, what do we do with that? Let's make a game about pirates where you're sailing across the ocean. Or we learn how to make a 3D model rotate and turn and said, well, let's make an airplane game with that. So a lot of the game ideas that we pursued were based on a technological trick kind of that we discovered, and we turned it into a game. You know, today the computers are so capable that, you know, you got to kind of hold yourself back and not, you know, not right. make a game forever. But in those days, it was kind of like, here's a new piece of technology. We'll, you know, we'll fill up our 32K of memory, and when it's full, we're done and we'll ship it. So very much a different world. But also, I assume, again, with your early days, you really weren't limited by what other people had done. You were kind of free to try anything yeah. because there were no, you know, no genres, no conventions, no, mm-hmm. no market research to tell you what path to follow. And so we had that kind of freedom in the early days.
Yeah. The difference between then and that, like now, pushing the limits of technology means you need 500 programmers to, you know, pull, like wring something out of the new graphics cards that they upgrade every year. Back then, that was just you finding some untapped potential of some little chip yourself as a programmer. I mean, you were designing and programming games personally, right?
I was not only that, I was doing the art and the sound. Wow. Basically the first 7 or 8 games that I made, I was the only person working on them.
Wow.
But the potential of what we could do graphically, et cetera, was not that great. So my art was good enough. My sounds were good enough. What was different then is we really, required the player to provide their imagination to fill in all the missing mm-hmm. colors and sounds and pieces. And, you know, we learned to do a lot with a little. And that has served us well, really. And you know, we learn that what happens in the player's mind is more important than what happens on the screen, regardless. Even today, it's mm-hmm. important to engage, you know, all of the player's brain and not, you know, not just try to amaze them with something cool that they're watching, but get them to imagine, you know, what that world is and what would I do in that world and what would I do next and how would I deal with this situation. Give them a lot of interesting things to think about so they're kind of their entire brain is engaged. And those were lessons we learned in those early days.
Yeah, that is, when I think back on my early days with video games, that's such an important piece of it, that it was happening in my mind, not just on the screen. Like, I think so much about all the art that came with video games in those days. You know, they had these big boxes with like a big painting on the front, you know, and they would often come with really lavish instruction manuals that were filled with art as well. You know, Nintendo had all these magazines and strategy guides and manuals and posters that like would depict the characters. And, you know, sometimes it'd be every spell you cast would have a different piece of art. Right. And that's because the graphics were so rudimentary. It was like, here's what it should look like in your mind. Picture exactly. This. When the screen flashes, when you cast Fireball, think of it like it's like this kind of, it's a lavish fantasy painting. And that's what it would mean to me in my head. That was why it was so transportive. And that was often more of, I was a child at the time, but it was more transportive of an experience than I often have today with games. And so that's really cool to hear that was something that you were like distinctly aware of when you were designing.
Yeah, it was all we could do. And what we find though is that as the graphics got better, as you know, everything, the presentation sounds got improved, that widened the audience, because not everybody was willing to make that commitment to imagining the fireball the way they seen it in the documentation. You know, I think as things got better and better, the audience grew. We've seen that, and now we have games that appeal to, you know, such a wide range of players. But in the early days, you had to bring your imagination to the table to play.
Now, one thing that I think is really interesting when you look at how art forms develop like this is so many art forms go from being basically pulp to like auteur driven. You know, if you look at film, if you look at comic books, graphic novels, things like that, they go from being, hey, we're just churning out B movies, you know, Westerns, who cares? They're just, you know, whatever. And then you start to like, some people start to really put extra effort in and they start to have their names attached to it. You know, Sergio Leone or Clint Eastwood, or like in comics, you know, the names of the artists, you know, Stan Lee and da da da. And you were one of the very first people to make that transition in games, because you were one of the very first game designers where people knew your name. And I like, that's why I'm excited to talk to you. I'm like, oh, Sid Meier, I've been seeing that name on the top of game boxes for years, in an age where nobody's name was on top of the box. It didn't say Shigeru Miyamoto's Mario on top. It took us longer to find out who he was. But your name was on there. What led to you putting your name on your games?
That was really a marketing strategy. We had done a couple of flight simulator games and a submarine game, a couple of military games. And I decided I wanted to make a pirates game. Wouldn't it be fun to make a pirates game, kind of more of a storytelling role-playing game? And my partner, Bill Staley, who was the creative guy. He was the marketing guy. He said, no, we need more of those military games because they like those military games. And I was like, well, no, I want to make a pirates game because pirates are cool. And he's
what a serious conversation. No, pirates are cool.
Pirates are cool.
You had no marketing research. That was all you had to go on, was I personally think pirates are cool.
Exactly. And so he said, well, we'll put your name on the game, so the people who like the military games might say, okay, it's the same person, and I like those games, so I'll give this game a try. And Pirates did well, so, you know, once something works, you stick with it. And it became kind of a brand, you know, of a certain type of game. And, you know, the irony to me is that as a game designer, our role is really to recede into the background. As a movie director or a singer or an artist, you're focused on that person. But in the game, our job is to kind of pull back and let you be the star. You'd make the big decisions. You feel the ownership of the experience. And so there's an irony that, and it's probably a reason why there aren't many games that have designers' names on them, because you don't want to feel that you're playing as Sid Meier. You want to feel that you're playing as yourself. And when you win, it's you that you know, gets the glory for that, not this Sid character. So it has become, you know, it's worked as a brand, but, you know, I think there are reasons why it hasn't become the norm in the industry, because the one unique thing that we have is the interactivity and the ability to make the player the key character in whatever it is. That's not true of a movie or a book or a piece of music.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the one uniqueness that we have, and we want to be careful not to take the attention away from the player.
Well, it's really interesting because I think there are some games where you do want to feel like you have total control. And then there are other times when I'm playing a game is I want to feel like I'm in good hands, and I want to feel like the person who created it had intent, and I'm going to, you know, enjoy an experience that they wanted me to have. I'm of two minds about it. I'm also of two minds about, you know, it's interesting that we know your name and we know, say, Hideo Kojima's name and a few people like that, but we don't know the names of so many other game designers who have had influence on the industry. And so I wonder how that's, you know, to the detriment of those designers, maybe to some extent. I wonder how the industry would be different if, you know, in the same way, every time you buy an album or stream an album, you know the name of the person who made the album. It's right there on it. If every single time you bought a video game, if everyone had followed your lead, right, and said Shigeru Miyamoto's Mario and, you know, this person's Castlevania, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
What that would have been, what the difference would have been. It's an interesting thought experiment.
Yeah, would have led to a whole nother set of discussions of like, why is there a new name on this game? What happened to this person? What,
yeah.
You know, kind of all the behind the scenes intrigue of you know,
true.
trying to track the. I think the problem is the personalities of designers is pretty boring. So people would be disappointed if they tried to figure out the gossip or the dirt behind all these designer yeah. names that they're seeing. You know, I think movie stars and singers and directors are much more interesting as individuals often than game designers.
Well, you know, I don't know if that's true, but I'll take you at your word for that.
All right.
When you think about a game that says Sid Meier on the top of it, right? Or when you think about yourself as a designer, what do you think characterizes your work as opposed to games designed by other folks? What are you interested in? And you know, when you look across your work, what sort of themes do you think you're exploring?
The games that I make are games that I want to play. I think that's one of the luxuries that we have, is that we can make games that we are excited about actually playing. And that hopefully that comes through in the final product, that we wanted to make this game, and it's about a topic that interests us, and it's presented in a way that we think is the most fun that we can make it. So we'll iterate, we'll try all sorts of different things to make the game as fun as it can be. And that, I think that's also a characteristic of our games, is that we tackle, you know, what might seem to be serious topics, things like civilization and outer space and pirates, I guess not so serious, but we try to present them in a very fun and accessible way. It's not a history lesson. It's not, the darker side of whatever. It's let's have some fun in this world. Let's see all the possibilities. I'll turn you loose to be a fighter pilot or a pirate or a king of a great civilization, and, you know, really focus on the fun and creative parts of those roles.
Yeah, let's talk about Civilization a little bit, because that game is enormously influential, very fun. It's still one of the most addictive games, people say, that it's the ultimate just one more turn game that people can't put down. I have many friends who've said they've had to delete it from their hard drive. And I also have that reaction with it too. I install the new version and I start playing, and then I lose a whole night to it. And I go, oh God, what happened? I can't play that anymore right now. I got work to do. I think it's a really interesting game I want to get to that point that you just made, because, it simultaneously feels like it's trying to be about the real world more than a lot of other games, especially at the time, where you were trying to track the progress of a human civilization in a way. But then on the other hand, it's also got like a real fantasy element, and that like the leaders of each civilization, no matter what year you start, Gandhi is in charge of India and Abraham Lincoln is in charge of America. And they're that way for what are supposedly got to be thousands of years, right? So they're like these weird historical avatars. It's not like, you know, if people know this company, it's not like a Paradox game where it's like really directly modeling real life as closely as it can. And so I think that's a really interesting place for it to be situated. And I don't know why situate it in that sort of middle zone?
Well, we basically made those decisions based on what we thought would be most fun for the player, to interact and meet great leaders, you know, people that, you know, Gandhi, Lincoln, Julius Caesar. They didn't hang around for 6,000 years. It's true. But you wouldn't want to meet, you know, the third cousin of Julius Caesar and have to negotiate with them. You want to talk to Julius Caesar himself.
Right.
So that was basically more fun that way. And, you know, the reason we thought it would be fun to make a game about the real world, was that, you know, the concepts, you know, that if I invent the wheel, that's going to come in handy somehow. If I discover gunpowder, I can make some great use of that. So yeah, that you are already familiar with the world. You're not having to learn the rules. You're not having to learn what does Sid think about this? It's like, I know these people, I know these concepts, and I'm going to put them to work to make the greatest civilization of all time.
Where did that idea come from? Oh, that's the worst question. I'm sorry. Why did I even ask you that? We're not going to edit it out. I want to prove to people that I ask bad questions like that. But tell me a little bit about the conception of that. We're 25 minutes into this interview and I haven't yet asked you about the conception of Civilization, one of the greatest game series of all time. So I'd just like to hear a little bit of that story.
Sure. It was a bit of its time. So, a year or two before that, SimCity had come out and had really been the first of these kind of building games. Sometimes they're called God games or Lego games or construction games or whatever. Games that were less about blowing things up and more about creating something.
Yeah.
And inspired by that, we did Railroad Tycoon, which is our first game in that genre, where you start very small, but you build tracks and stations and, you know, you kind of end up with this great railroad empire. And we kind of said, you know, that was fun. That was a fun game. We liked that idea of starting small, but ending up somewhere where, you know, that no one has ever made this exact same railroad. For example, you've created something unique. And what's a topic even bigger than that we could apply this idea to? And it was the history of civilization, you know, starting with one city, one settler, a little piece of land, and gradually exploring, gradually building more cities, gradually negotiating, running into different leaders, discovering new technology. It had that very much that kind of easy to start playing, you know, simple at the beginning, but gradually layering on more and more interesting things, and very hard to stop playing because there's always one more thing, one more turn to see what's going to happen next.
And how much of that process of coming up with those concepts, how much of that, I'm very curious, was preconceived, where you're like, I kind of want to make a game that feels like this, versus how much did you discover along the way? I'm sure it's a mix of both, but where is that weighted for you?
We are continuously iterating as we make games. I mean, I'm constantly playing the game, adding a new feature, trying it out, fixing it if it doesn't work, take it out, change it, make it better, whatever. So we had a general idea that it would be fun to make a game about, you know, with all these historical ideas that allowed you to create a civilization, but how the exact nature of how that would all work was iterated on, you know, daily, basically. So, you know, at one point the tech tree came along and we said, oh, this is a great way to hang, you know, unveiling new things, giving the player decisions to make about what direction they wanted to take their technology, explaining why stuff wasn't available at the beginning, you know, kind of allowing the game to grow in kind of detail and depth. The kind of a hidden map, the map where you're gradually exploring and uncovering more and more of it.
Yeah.
Many of those elements were, you know, we discovered that, oh, this works. This kind of gives you something to look forward to. It creates this whole anticipation about what's going to happen next. And that's kind of the key to One More Turn is I just got to see what happens, you know, when I cross that ocean or once I get that technology, you know, that's going to, I'm building this wonder when that's done. Then, so you always have a couple of things to anticipate and look forward to.
That's really interesting because Civilization originated so many of these concepts that, you know, we've seen in games since that are like really deeply embedded in the medium now and have even made their way into other mediums. But the way you just described it made it sound less like you're creating these concepts than that you're discovering them, almost like an explorer in Civilization discovering a new continent. Like by this process, you are stumbling across them and saying, oh, there's something here that maybe we didn't anticipate. Do you relate to that or no?
Yeah, I think given that we're playing the game every day, we can actually, you know, interrogate ourselves and say, okay, you played. You had this much fun, but what would have made it more fun, or what was missing for you, or what didn't work, or what was unclear? And then we would fix those things. You know, it's almost like a sculpture, like you, okay, now we need to add an arm to this thing, you know, or that, you know, it's kind of like, given that we're making a game that we want to play, we are kind of like the focus group, our own internal focus group. In, you know, one half of our head is the focus group and the other half is the designer. And we're kind of, asking ourselves those questions. What would make it more fun? You know, was that, did it take too long to do this? All those kind of questions about what would make the game better. And, you know, things like the tech tree exploration, those all came about by trying them and realizing, oh, you know, this is more fun now. This works better now. I'm more engaged. I've got two or three things that I'm really, you know, looking forward to. So this is starting to work.
Now, when you look at the history of this franchise, going from Civilization 1, 1991, to I think we're up to 6 today. And
yes, we are.
I'm sure they're working on 7. I'm sure you've had a meeting or two about 7. How much do you recognize your own decisions and your own discoveries that you made back then in the game today? What is your relationship with it now?
I think what we've tried to understand is what is the appeal of the game, because when it came out, it was very different from just about everything else that was out there. There were a couple of games, you know, in that genre, but most games were action or, you know, about, like we say, about blowing things up instead of building them. And just the idea of strategy was a very negative. No games were strategy games. Strategy was like boring and hexes and, you know, only for nerds. We want action, no strategy. So we claim that we made the world safe for strategy because, you know, after that, everything was strategy, real-time strategy, turn-based strategy, you know. Suddenly strategy was okay. It was actually a good thing. So we try to understand, you know, what had we created and why had it been successful? And given that we're going to do a sequel and another sequel and maybe another sequel, what are those core elements that we want to retain? And that is our thinking, you know, every time we look at doing a new Civilization, it's kind of like, here are the core elements that have to be there. It's going to be turn-based. You're going to meet great leaders. You're going to discover cool technology. But what are the new things we can add? We haven't done much with espionage yet. We haven't done much with the environment. We haven't done much with religion. So it's kind of a balance of keeping those core elements, but also introducing new things that complement what we already have.
Yeah.
And then, you know, as you say, we've been able to get up to Civilization VI. With the support of an amazing community of players and gamers and folks that have provided actually some great game design ideas and some great mods to the series that has kept it you know, even more energized.
It's a dialogue.
It is. It's a community that really supports us and lets us do what we do.
Well, I have so many more questions for you. I really want to ask about what your games have to say about the world we live in and how you feel the industry's changed. But we got to take a really quick break. We'll be right back with more Sid Meier.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Okay, we're back with Sid Meier. How do you feel the, you know, games as a medium have changed? I mean, first of all, I'd like to ask, you know, when you got started, and, you know, you would have dinner with people and say, hey, I'm a game designer. Was that something that people even understood what that meant?
No. Very, very bizarre profession to have at that time. Most people didn't play games. It was a very, very small core group of us that played and understood games. And, you know, we had our own magazines and our own conventions where we got together to reassure ourselves that we weren't about to die off and disappear. It did not register with people, I think. And that has changed, of course. Now everybody is familiar with games and curious about how they get made. And, if people are Civilization players, they always have one or two thoughts about, you know, what could be improved, what should be different, why did you do this? Things have changed very much in terms of the visibility of game designers.
And the way that the industry operates is so massively different. I mean, it was a bedroom industry in your time. Like, you created the games all by yourself. There are still people who do that. And those are still some of my favorite games. And it is a wonderful part of the industry, but it's very, very small compared to, you know, the scale on which, I mean, how many people worked in the last Civilization? Hundreds?
50 to 70 people.
That's a team. That's a mid-sized team. There are games that have hundreds of people working on them.
There are.
Have multiple designers, programmers, et cetera, et cetera. And the industry produces billions of dollars. Video games are, you know, bigger than movies often when the largest games make billions all by themselves, which movies struggle to do. You know, from a labor perspective, there's a lot of issues in the industry. There's rampant overwork and underpayment and discrimination. There's all the issues that a large industry has, right? Mm-hmm. I'm curious, as someone who's been tracking along the whole time, and as you're now at the point you've written a memoir about your time in games, right? So you've been doing it for a while. Do you look at it today and say, God, I don't know how I could hack it if I were to start? Or do you look at it and say, oh, my God, I'd love to get in there. It's a great time.
a little of each, actually. In some ways, it's a great time to become a game designer. We have tools out there like Unity and Unreal that kind of do a lot of the grunt work that we used to have to do ourselves. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of jump right in and start making games a lot more quickly. There are libraries of models and all, you know, all sorts of pieces that you can use to put things together. So I think it's easier to kind of get to a certain point to, you know, to get something that looks like a game. The problem is that the goalposts have moved way down to the other end of the field. So to get something that looks anything, you know, like a Fortnite or whatever is still a lot of work.
Yeah.
And
massive.
And it's the you know, one of the situations that I see is that once you've got something that looks like a game, it's tempting to think that you have a game. when all you have is something that looks like a game.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to, are there those interesting decisions? Is it, you know, is it fun to play? Does it have depth? Does it have replayability? Those are not things that you can press a button and, you know, there's no replayability button that you press to add that
right.
to your game. So in those ways, I think there's, you know, there's advantages these days that you can get moving very quickly and get something that looks pretty good quickly. But to get to an actual game is still, you still got to do some hard work.
Well, and when you describe it as quickly, like the part that you're making something that looks like a game, right? You're talking about like the graphics, having a character running around, the sound effects, all those sorts of things. Those now require so many dozens of people putting in years of effort to make those sometimes, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That it often seems the bar has been raised in many ways where, you know, when... underneath, you still need that great gameplay. You need something that interesting for the players to be doing. But a lot of people also expect this extremely high budget look in many ways, which is, I don't know. It seems like, it seems like the bar has been raised a bit, perhaps. Maybe it's difficult to say whether the barriers to entry have gone up or down.
True, because we have the whole indie scene and, you know, there's the iTunes store where you know, there's casual games. There's a lot more types of games that are out there and a lot more ways to get into, you know, to get into gaming. On the other hand, the bar is raised for a lot of games and the expectations are pretty high.
But I love this distinction you made about, are there interesting decisions, right? That no matter what a game looks like, underneath the player, the game is going to be happening in the player's mind, right? And the player
right.
needs to have a rich, fulfilling interaction with it. So break down some of what goes into making that work that way. What are the interesting decisions? What does that mean?
Yeah, that's kind of one of our basic tools that we use to analyze a game or think about a game, especially when it's not working. What's gone wrong? You know, it's at one point we're kind of asking ourselves, what is fun? You know, we say we are looking for fun. We're trying to make fun.
Yeah. What is fun? Sid?
What
Hold
is
on a
fun?
Second.
What the
hell does fun even mean? Can you define fun?
Well, we have our definition. So we feel that a game, needs to be a series of interesting decisions.
Hmm.
Now that's kind of a very general, metric that we can basically apply to anything that we're trying to call a game. And by interesting decisions, we mean the player is choosing a path, but the other paths look almost as interesting as the one that they have chosen.
Hmm.
So that they're thinking, oh, next time I play, I'm going to try that option. Or, you know, they feel... That they're controlling the path of the game. They're controlling how things go forward. So they have ownership. They have an investment in the outcome. But we've provided them these interesting choices so that they've kind of had some interesting things to consider. Kind of where turn-based has an advantage that the player can take the time they want. We can present them with somewhat more interesting decisions because they're on. The taking whatever time they want to make those decisions. But, you know, planting that seed of replayability, next time I'm going to try this path, these two technologies, I could, you know, I've got to choose one. I'd like to have them both. But right now, my strategy is military. So I'm going to go with this one. But next time I play, I might try a more technologically oriented strategy. I'm going to try, you know, go with this technology.
Yeah.
So we've kind of planted all these seeds of the next time I play. There's more to this game that I, you know, that I'm going to be able to experience the first time. I'm going to try it again. So these interesting decisions kind of, you know, draw you into the world. You've got to imagine, you know, if I go this path, what's going to happen next? And you know, again, we've got your imagination engaged in playing and projecting what might happen in the future.
Yeah, that's really interesting because, I mean, you described the turn-based nature of it and how it happens in the player's mind. That occurs to me that when you're playing Civilization or a game like it, you are spending most of your time just scrolling around the map, looking at it, just going like, okay, I have these units over here and I'm trying to build this over there. And oh, what's in the tech tree? And let me make some choices. And you probably spend 90% of your time doing that. And then you hit next turn and then the game finally powers up and does all the results, and then you pause again and you start staring at it one more time, and that is very unique. That, you know, most of the time the true action is happening in your mind because the real gameplay is you puzzling through the decisions.
Yeah, you are living in the future, basically. If I do this, then this might happen. Okay, but if I do this, then this is going to happen. So you're kind of constantly imagining what could happen if I go this way or that way. And then eventually you make a decision, and you it's not always quite that slow, but you are spending, you know, most of your time projecting and living in the future of the game. And of course, then you want to see whether it actually happens. You know, you got to play that one more turn to see whether what you imagined in your mind actually comes, takes place.
Now, this is a very rote interview question, but I am genuinely interested. Did you have any inkling that you were creating something that was going to last this long, that was going to go through this many iterations?
Not at all. And actually, when Civilization came out, I think we had a flight simulator game released around the same time that really got the majority of the attention of the company, and, you know, was expected to do, be the main product. I forget what it was, and I'm sure it did okay, but Civilization took on a life of its own, but a little bit gradually. It took 2 or 3 months for us to start getting this feedback and players to respond and, you know, get this sense that it was gradually, you know, taking off, and it had a longevity to it. It had a word of mouth to it, that we felt it was a good game. We enjoyed playing. We had one more turn experiences ourselves, but it was very different from anything else that was out there. And so we had, you know, we had no surety that it was going to be successful.
Well, what about the games industry? Did you have any suspicion, hey, this weird little industry we're working on, this is going to fucking take over the world one day? It's going to be bigger than Hollywood, which I believe it is at this point.
I believed early on that it should, and it had that potential. I felt that the fact that we were interactive, that we were presenting the player with the opportunity to be the star, was unique to what we had to offer. Now, we had a lot of work to make it look good, sound good, feel good, play good. But if we could capitalize on that uniqueness that we had, the player engagement, the player's role as the leading character, that it would become a very compelling form of entertainment and rival some of the other ones. We were counting on people to be willing to be active, you know, as opposed to passive, to be engaged, you know, and we found that people enjoyed that. They enjoyed playing games. They enjoyed sharing the experience very much with other players. And I think so when the internet came along, it's fun to talk about it, you know, a TV show that you like or a movie that you like with other people. But talking about a game experience that you had, that you owned and that you were invested in with other people, I think is just more compelling, more interesting. So we had this advantage And I think we did a good job of building on it and taking advantage of it. The technology advances, you know, were nothing but helpful. You know, more colors, more sounds, CD-ROM, internet, multiplayer. I mean, a lot of these technological advancements have made games more fun and more engaging. And, you know, we've ridden that wave of technology to make games better and better. So between all those things, we've become, you know, a very successful part of the entertainment industry.
But it really strikes me that, you know, at the end of the day, it is, again, the gameplay. All the graphics and the colors are wonderful, but, you know, it is the core game experience underneath. I think about a game like Among Us. I don't know if you've heard of this game. Came out. It's basically a video game version of Mafia or Werewolf, that type of game. I've been playing it with friends almost every day. It's taken the world by storm, and it actually is a little similar to, it's a very small team, you know, the graphics are pretty rudimentary, they nailed this experience that people want to have, that, you know, the game is happening in the player's minds as they argue with their friends about who the imposter is. That core of it still exists as much as everything has changed.
Yeah, I think, you know, you could look at a game like Minecraft. Very rudimentary graphics, very, you know, basic. But it's genius. So there doesn't have to be, you know, the best graphics, et cetera. You know, back in the day, Tetris was very popular, very simple looking game. But, you know, again,
still is popular.
Still is popular.
They've made it look prettier. They've made it look more impressive. Tetris Effect is an incredibly beautiful version of Tetris, but it's still Tetris.
Yeah. So, you know, gameplay is the one thing that we have to offer uniquely, and, you know, I think it, you know, serves us well to focus on that and make sure that is a key part of what we do.
Are you still playing? What was the last game that you played that inspired you, that you're like, oh my God, this game's amazing?
I've been playing some of the indie games just to kind of cleanse my palate from working on games. There was a game, Flame in the Fire, I think it was called. I'm not sure. I have the Xbox
Game Pass
subscription, so you can sample all sorts of different games. Flame in the Flood, I think it was
called. Flame in the Flood, that's what I thought. Yeah.
That was fun. And Overland was another game, again, a little indie game that I've been having fun with.
So, another turn-based game. Do you still gravitate towards turn-based?
Yeah, I think so. I'm usually, yeah, I mean, if I'm traveling, which I don't do anymore, but, often I'll be playing on my iPad or something. So those games tend to be suitable for that kind of gameplay. I like racing game, like, you know, Forza or, those games as well. So it's not just turn-based, but, I like actually both kinds of games, but
you said, working on, it's a nice break from working on games. Tell me a little bit about what it's like for you working on games now. If you, whatever project you can mention, I'd be happy to hear about, but I'm also just curious, what kind of teams are you working on? You know, how are you still embedded in the industry?
Well, I'm, for me, the most fun is the early parts of game making. You know, I'm really exploring a lot of different possibilities. So I will, I'll be working on one or two prototypes generally of game ideas. Some of them eventually turn into games. Others don't. It's a pretty small team. Usually just myself and I work with a programmer who kind of helps me to, you know, created almost a prototyping designed environment where we have all these different, you know, models. I mean, if you imagine having access to everything that was ever made for Civilization, we've got, you know, tanks and airplanes and buildings and all sorts of fun pieces to play with for putting something together. So I'm generally looking at, you know, new ways of taking these assets and tools that we have. And, you know, what could we do in terms of a game experience? So basically, I'm doing game design.
That's great.
Every day. It is a great job.
Have you ever thought about going back to your roots and just like, hey, I'm just going to program this thing from scratch. Let's do it. Let's do a one man band version of gaming again.
That is, that's the problem with the Sid Meier name, to be honest with you.
That's what people expect.
Sid Meier couldn't do that. there's the burden.
Yeah. Too much work.
It's like, Sid, you're getting lazy there. come on. We're expecting big things. So,
well, it's also a hugely team-based industry, and it's the same as, you know, my favorite joke from my friend's show, from my friend Raphael's show, BoJack Horseman, is, you know, it's a TV is a medium where hundreds of people do incredible work and one person gets all the credit. And it must feel like that for you a little bit as well, I imagine.
Yeah. I mean, we clearly, there's a lot that goes into making a game like Civilization, and great artists and programmers and so many things that are really expected and almost taken for granted these days.
Let's end with this. What do you tell budding young game designers who want to break in? What are your thoughts? I know what I tell people who say, how do I do comedy, right? It's the same speech over and over. I've given it hundreds of times now, and I know what it is. I'm not going to tell you folks listening right now. You'll have to come find a costume in a dark alley to hear it. But what is your version of it? What do you tell people?
Well, a couple of levels. I mean, if you want to be a game designer, the first thing we say, you've got to design games. I mean, the technology is there. There's no reason why, you can't learn programming, can't take advantage of some of these tools. Things like Roblox or whatever have the ability to make your own game. Mm-hmm. Don't expect it, obviously, to be, a AAA title, but as we've kind of discussed, it's that core gameplay that is the elusive element, not all those other pieces. So, kind of one is make games. Now, the problem is that doesn't make you a game designer. You have to figure out how to get your game to the public. And there are a couple of things we talk about there. One, if you want to be in the AAA game world, you need to have a skill that a AAA game company is going to value, mm-hmm. whether it's programming, art, even playtesting or producing. Get into a company, and once you're in the door, there are often opportunities to contribute to a game that's in design and kind of demonstrate that you've got some great game design ideas, and then perhaps you'll become an assistant game designer and eventually a lead game designer. Or you can go the indie path, and that's another, if you want to take that route, it's obviously you're competing with hundreds and thousands of other games and designers out there. But if your idea is unique and there's probably a little bit of luck involved, if you can go viral, then right. you might be successful. So, but the first thing would be to make a game. That's the first step.
Well, let me ask you this, and I'm sorry I said that we'd end with that, but I do have one more question because it's something I think a lot about. What do you have any concerns about, working conditions, structural issues in the industry? Because in both those paths you just talked about, right, AAA games are notorious for overworking folks, for people burning out early, right, crunching. They have, forced mandatory 18-hour work days, and then people tend to stay in the industry for like a couple years and then leave and go do something else because it's it depends on where you're working, but that is a pattern that we've seen. And then in indie games, well, that has a problem of, you've got these massive platforms like Steam that sort of are controlling the flow of players. And so those viral moments, we have so many more indie games competing, and those viral games are a lot harder to produce. And so it's much more competitive. You have people who are spending years of their lives making a game that never is able to reach players. As someone working in the entertainment industry, I'm very concerned about, this sort of thing in my industry. And I'm just curious what your view is on those issues, or if you have one. If you don't, that's fine.
Well, I think things have evolved. I mean, I kind of took a chance on being a game designer, hoping it would become a viable profession back in the early day. I quit my day job and became a game designer. That was risky. And I think at any point in time, If you're going to pursue your passion, you might end up taking some risks. Today, it's a different situation. I think, you know, you're definitely, the market is huge. The level of competition is huge. There are a lot of people who would like to become game designers. I mean, it's actually a college course now. I mean, I was amazed the first time I heard, oh, they're teaching game design at the university.
Right.
Parents are paying tens of thousands of dollars for their children to learn game design.
Right.
It's like, don't become, you know, it's almost like becoming a musician or, you know, it's that kind of a profession now where there are probably more people that want to do it, then there's going to end up being space for it.
But comedy is certainly that way too.
So if you've got the talent and you know and the drive and the vision and the dream, there's lots of opportunities out there. There's lots of great games still being made. So just understand what the ground rules are of the game, as it were.
Well, Sid, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show to tell us about it. Thank you so much. And thanks for all the innumerable hours that I have put into your games. Time well spent. And I thank you for it.
You're very welcome.
Well, thank you once again to Sid Meier for coming on the show. If you enjoyed that interview as much as I did, please leave us a rating or review wherever you subscribe. It really does help us out. Now, I want to remind you that we are going to be doing Stitcher Premium subscriber episodes, special episodes in which I and some comedian guest stars will be answering your questions. So please send your questions, any question at all, to me at factually@adamconover.net. That's factually@adamconover.net. And look for those episodes in the new year. I want to thank our producers, Kimmy Lucas and Sam Roundman, our engineer, Andrew Carson, Andrew WK, for our theme song. I want to thank Falcon Northwest for building me the incredible gaming PC that I record this show on and that you can watch me use to stream on Twitch at twitch.tv/AdamConover. You can find me on at Adam Conover or wherever you get your social media, or just, I don't know, look me up on DuckDuckGo or whatever. You guys know how to do it. And look, we'll see you again in the new year. I know it's been a rough one, but you know, tomorrow is always another day in which we can make the world a little bit better place than it was yesterday. That's what I'm going to wake up on January 1st thinking, and I hope you do too. So thank you so much for listening, and above all, don't forget to stay curious.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. The Daily Show podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, wherever you get your podcasts.